How this came about was, I'll start with the book. I'm not going to give you my nice history because it's boring. You don't want to know that. But I started out in the art. I was an apprentice in the print industry. I got a scholarship. I could always draw.
Okay.
So, you know, it was the late 60s, early 70s. I came to London and it was just unbelievable.
Everything was happening.
I walked off to King's Cross.
Yes.
So I got, and I've done an interview a few years ago about all this, which is so much response to it, you know, about you kind of coming to London and getting work, you know, and I was making tons of money.
Mm.
I was really enjoying it. I was getting incredibly interesting. I did Saturday after Saturday, a half page in the Times.
Wow.
Book review. I got any book I wanted to do, they would send me a book and I'd say, oh, I'll read that. And it was this size, so I got, and I would get a check back, I couldn't believe. And I didn't know agents, and I could go in and say, I want my drawings back. That was the only deal I wanted to keep my drawings. And people would write to the paper, but I'd sell them. Until one day I went to a meeting with Ralph Steadman and Gerald Scar and Roger Law, who did Fluck and Law.
Yes.
So Roger's an amazing guy. And we all went along to this thing, a very glam lady in the Hilton, and she said, I want you to, I want Stuart, you come on trials, because I'd done trials. Anyway, and we all said, oh, that's fantastic. She said, well, hey, he's come over for 6 months to the States. And I said, what's it for? And she said, Playboy magazine. I said, Playboy
magazine.
I'm an old lefty. So anyway, the upshot of that was, what people forget is that there was a war going on. There was a Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in a Vietnam War.
Yes.
I was, you know, reading a lot, partly because of the work I was getting. I was doing
yes.
a lot of work to
yes.
illustrate. And I started to, so it was in the 70s I started reading.
Okay. Really connected with
really
the material.
And how I would describe Philip K. Dick. People say, oh, Philip K. Dick's a sci-fi writer. I would say, push that to one side. What is at the heart of Philip K. Dick's story? They're all the same. Mm-hmm. They are this. You are a reader, and you have a knock on your door, and you open your door, and whatever confronts you turns your world upside down. And Dick then says, come with me to a new world.
Yes.
And I'm going to ask you, time and time again, what values do you hold on to when your world is turned upside down? So you came from that world, I'm taking you to this, and I'm going to ask you, what do you hold on to? Family, love, trust, honour, all these things. So I used to wait expecting, you didn't. The internet was always difficult. Some stuff would be published, a lot of short stories. He was a prolific writer, but it was difficult to get this. But I read Man in the High Castle. I saw Ridley Scott's Blade Runner, because he was reading this stuff, excited by Blade Runner, Strange World. But then he wrote Man in the High Castle, Socialist, Vietnam War. And he was writing a story which was his story of Man in the High Castle, which again, because we are now reading and watching this on Amazon in 2015, it was written in the 1960s, you know, and in that period, we were bombing the hell out of Vietnam, and he was saying, what would have happened? This was only, you know, the war finished in the Second World War, 1945, so it was only a few years after the
yes.
two generations of it. So he was saying to us, what would have happened today
yes.
in the 1960s?
If the Nazis had won the war and the Japanese.
It was tangible,
yes,
real.
Because
tangible.
People could still remember, because it was less than a generation since the war happened.
So at that moment, I thought, why is Ridley Scott not making this movie? It was so, so redolent, so current, so powerful, and we as readers were reading it in the light of I was born in 48, so I think my father, there's so many people who were the Second World War was really part of all my life. So end of Philip K. Dick,
okay.
You know, he world goes on. I started working, I could move out of drawing, I get film and television, documentaries and all kinds of stuff. But I was working with Ridley in his company in Los Angeles, Scott Free, and I had the opportunity to say to Ridley, why did you do that? You know, make this thing. He said, you'll never get the rights. For some reason, he said he told me the story that he got to know Dick. Dick wanted to write a sequel and started to write that sequel to Man in the High Castle. So he said to Ridley, yes, when I finished the sequel, which he never did. And Ridley said things moved on, but I don't know why, but family have always protected that novel and that's never been made.
Mm.
So I thought, hey, here's an opportunity. I could raise the money here in the UK for a TV series involving Ridley as a director and with finances here if I get the rights. So I approached Fremantle Media, who we had at that point, a very helpful deal with them. It was a first-week arrangement.
Yes. Okay.
And it was then under management of a man called David Ellender, who I think is a visionary. He's running a very successful company now in Los Angeles, Los Angeles.
I've heard of that.
So a very nice man, very good guy. He approached me and this is the a year before we started with this project. I'd set up this business to make long-form drama. Now this was 8 or 9 years ago.
Yes.
And my kids all started to watch 24. This was probably 15 years ago. They were all kind of young teens, early teens. I would go to America. They would want me to bring back a box set. And we were watching his DVDs. So for me, I thought, what is coming is long-form drama, which is really grabbing my children, and they're not watching television. And it was the beginning of the internet, you know, so long ago. Everyone was on video. So I set up this business to make long-form drama for an international market, and then we couldn't get any traction. No one was interested
really?
In Europe. No one was interested, except David Ellender. And David approached me and said, look, I've heard you talking about this.
Mm.
We built a very successful company on the back of entertainment, live shows entertainment.
Yes.
That will come to an end, and I want to position us, I want to, you know, be a producer, long-form drama. So I said the one thing I want to hold on to is I want to make this drama from a European perspective, but for a world audience. So he backed out. He said, we won't get our development money. They're a big international sales outfit. So with the combination of having access to these funds, over the phone, David would say, you've got potential to get the rights that I did. If you do this with Ridley, it's a no-brainer, we will do it. And I said, well, let's do it in partnership with a broadcaster, UK broadcaster. Let's make it. Let's make it.
Yes.
Because as you know, at that time, and still in the BBC, it's very hard to get, it's very hard to get anything. Right? The tradition, as you will know, that we're running two different businesses. European business,
yes.
British business, the market is relatively small, and the economy is related to that. So German broadcaster, you know, the tradition of the last 40, 50 years is you make television for your domestic market. You buy in American shows and you double them. Buy in some British shows and double them. And the same in Britain, same in France, same in Italy. America, have a
different
huge
market, of course, yes.
Businesses set up in a different way. So it's a cycle of pilots do an hour and then you do 10, 11, 12 hours. And if it's a returning series, you get another 12, you know, they can run for 20 years. The Dallas and so on. We were familiar with that in Britain, but we didn't produce that. It was a six-part, was a big commission. The only returning series were soaps. So soaps, or if you were into drama, then you would get a six-part. An example of this would be a silent witness, would be six parts. And
once,
six
exactly
parts,
every year, yes.
Parts. So you did build up. So on the international side, there was a market for these.
Because you could sell these through and say, we've got 36 episodes of X.
Yeah. So if you go to a UK broadcaster 8 years ago, still go today, and say, I want to make 10 parts to go into the international.
They'd be horrified.
Horrified, you know, they show you the door, and or they glaze over. So what you had to do in Europe was to work, my plan was to work with the Fremantle.
Mm.
And the Fremantle, although we get six parts, the original idea was to do 6 hours with based on the novel Man in the High Castle, acquire the rights, commission the writer, working with a broadcaster and a sales company. And the view was that if it worked as a six-part, if BBC didn't want to do another six-part, then we would do we would find another broadcaster, we'd retain the rights. So we structured the deal with the BBC along the same by Fremantle. So when I went to the BBC, Ridley was very excited about doing it. I got, after a long kind of conversations with the help of Scott Free, access to the estate, and who were very protective for good reason.
Mm.
Not wanting the Man in the High Castle to be disturbed in any way, for us to, whoever made this, I then got a list of all his publications, but I thought I'd read a lot of Philip K. Dick. The upshot of it was, we got this commission, these contracts.
They take years, don't they? Yes.
Years, I mean, it was maybe 2 years, a year to get the rights, then a year to contract. A hero of mine, Howard Brenton,
yes.
Who was one of the great playwrights in the 80s when I was growing up, and he had then, recently, a year before, he'd written six or seven episodes of our
Top
Show.
But American or English?
Well, English. Great series. Anyway, Howard had written this, and I rang Howard and said, Howard, I don't know if you, you know, frankly, Philip K. Dick, you know, it's true, old socialist, would you be of interest in this? He said, Stuart, it's so strange. He said, I read it when it was published. I love it.
Mm.
I was recently in New York.
Yes.
He said, I was in a bookshop, saw the list of Philip K. Dick's books, republished, a beautiful edition,
yes.
Taken off the shelf, read it. Right. He went out and said, Stuart, on the phone,
yes.
I would die.
Yes.
So, BBC, beatings of the BBC, and we're very excited about Howard writing it. And so he wrote two episodes, which is most unusual for BBC. You know, there's no pilot this time, you know. It's
no.
Just commissioned the series. Well, let's do one, then let's do another. It's like, how do we get into this world?
Yes.
And there was an ongoing debate with the estate, the daughter, and another guy, two people involved in this, a lawyer, who have a real input, so they want to be involved in editorial discussions. So Scott Reed,
yes.
Deadline.
Okay.
And, so there was a discussion, endless discussions about how you would deal with them. Now, one of the things, which is a geek thing, but in the novel, you know that the Man in the High Castle has published a book, and that book is circulating. So if you go back to the 60s, what would be circulating would be Mao's trash. You'd go around to Chinatown, guys, you know, the Mao shop,
yes.
And you get these books. There was a resonance with this. Now, it was Howard who said, you can't have a book. This is the 21st century. What we want is films to be circulated. And this was a big thing for the estate. Should we make a shift? And what technology would we be using? So, anyway, for me, it was a very exciting moment because I thought to make a guy, you know, to talk about a text, which had been written, which was dangerous to the fascist regime, would be very difficult to dramatise.
Be too dry, really.
Be too dry.
Yes.
So anyway, the obvious thing, perhaps it's obvious, but
newsreel
at the time it was a big kind of...
Yeah.
So we produced this, that was the idea. So two episodes were produced, and it went back into BBC management, and the BBC said, wow, they were very excited about the show. However, this is where I've got to be careful, but what became clear is that the BBC had then just commissioned Jane Campion to do this show in Australia.
The Top of the Lake.
Top of the Lake.
Yes.
And they said, look, it's very difficult for us to do a show for a big international story, which is shot in Australia, and to do another, which is shot in the States. So I said, well, this is hugely disappointing, because we spent 3 years on the understanding, you putting money into this. Anyway, it went to senior management. There was a lot of discussion about it. Anyway, the decision was that, which, you know, you accept, they said, if we were to make a choice between, you know, this show and another show, we think that you, Stuart, have the ability to set this up in the US, whereas some of the other shows that BBC will get involved in, they basically said, no, we won't make it. So I didn't want to make it in the US. I have to say that. I wanted this to have a European sensibility, where fascism had destroyed Central Europe. I grew up in that world, post-fascist world. You know, I got a scholarship to study in Berlin when the wall was up, and I lived in Berlin. This, a European perspective on a story of a world domination of fascism, and with a Japanese perspective, will give another, a richer dimension to it. We will tell stories from a European perspective, we tell them from an American perspective. It will have a different resonance. So that door was closed, and I was deeply disappointed. I thought there was a missed opportunity to take what is a world classic. You know, we're just watching War and Peace.
Yes.
And, you know, it's a world classic, and how many people know that much about, you know, that world and that culture? But it's a classic and recognised. Why, for a younger audience, can't we introduce a modern classic, which is a Philip K. Dick, huge audience?
Is there still a bit of a snobbery? Over the years, I've interviewed Brian Aldiss, and I've interviewed him quite a few times.
Wow. There you go.
There is a snobbery.
There is.
About this kind of material, which is ridiculous. I mean, someone like Ray Bradbury, who was one of the greatest writers of the 20th century, you know, even though his work was brilliant, his books won't be on English literature syllabuses because they're using science fiction and fantasy as a sort of prism for ideas about society.
Yeah. And they reach an audience in a way that other stories pick
with a little bit of audience, yes, exactly.
So that was perhaps an element that was not discussed, it was never made clear. What was made clear was you, as his producer, Stuart, could set this up in the US, and it would be difficult. But politics were a small for the BBC to commissioning a show which was shot in the US, set principally in the US, and there was discussion, to be fair to the BBC, they said, could we pool the story to get more focus in Europe? And I said, never. This is a story that, it's like taking, you know, one of the classics and saying, oh well,
why can't we set it in Philadelphia or something? Or
so, and I said, so we went then to two guys who I know, we mentioned, but they were really senior at Universal Sci-Fi.
In the States.
They both knew of it. There was a big announcement, it went incredible. Incredible viral interest in the show. I mean, really.
So the two episodes have been written, but haven't been shot, obviously.
Correct.
Basically.
But it was announced. You know, Fremantle, you know,
acquired the rights, and they're about to start work on
it. So we announced it, announcing Frank. Yes. And Frank Dice. Then it was announced with Howard.
Yes.
And the BBC. And then, so everyone knew about it, approached by a lot of people, and said, we're very interested in what stage it's at. So Universal had been most aggressive about it, said, wow, you know, we would like
we
to
want
be
this.
Involved. So the moment it happened, it was just a phone call to them. Very intelligent guy. I mean, really, this was not just what you're saying. It's assumption of sci-fi is I don't know, comics or something. It's trivial. These are profound, important storytelling that will be read and, you know, forever.
Yes.
These guys really understood it. So the estate, again, were very cautious about it. We're really impressed. We all were. We signed a contract, which took another year, you know, where you're ground into the dust. but, you know, we were very happy to be making it with you two guys. And then I had a call from one of us saying we've all been
let go, basically.
A week or two of hiatus, and then we were told by senior management that it was a huge sweep and we were free to.
So you could take it wherever you wanted, there'd be no legal implications.
You'd pay everyone, you always to pay back costs and so on. Standard stuff. I mean, that's, I think, fairly fast.
Yes.
There was one thing that Universal did, which was breathtaking to me, was the day we signed the contract, literally the day, they had bought out from BBC, paid all the historic costs, paid the past cost of rights in a number of years, and committed to another stage in the script, and wanted to make six parts. And the call came to say, we would like to we want to bring an American voice on the show. And I said, well, as a rewrite. And they said, no, we want to start again.
You mean having like a new showrunner, basically?
We wanted, Howard was
out of the picture, basically.
Out of the picture, and we want to bring in an American showrunner. Now, by chance, by pure chance, I had been introduced to Frank Spotnitz, who came to London to move his family to London.
Really?
He'd been working in Los Angeles.
There was X-Files, wasn't it?
X-Files.
He did that for a hell of a long time.
He didn't create it.
Jesus,
he was
the
principal writer.
Yes.
So I got to know Frank. There is nothing to do with this. This had been going on.
Yes.
He and I were talking about it being going on.
Yes.
He and I were... He's a exceptionally nice man, and I was a real man. And he and I talked about various projects and working together. I was also talked about, you know, what it was like coming to London and yeah. where she's maybe looking for a flat. You know, we talked about agents. I made some sort of introductions. He was looking really to bring his young family. He had worked, if I'm not mistaken, I do know he worked 100%. He worked in Paris when he was a young man. I think he worked for Reuters as a writer.
Oh, really?
So he had
a European perspective as an American, yes. basically.
And I thought, as soon as we had this call, what a perfect
yes.
choice of a man who brings all the kind of experience. I mean, you couldn't get a more experience and a high profile. And the X Files in the UK.
It was a massive show. It was huge.
I mean, I remember the Guardian.
Yeah, too. Same here. All the covers. All the magazine covers.
Yeah. And they did a pull out of the G2. You know.
Yeah, I remember.
And
that.
I bet it was an interview with Frank, you know. So I thought, wow, here we have a
synchronicity, basically.
Just, it was a, it couldn't have been better. So just suddenly went like that. Mm. You can get Frank. So Frank was brought, and there was another, this was the third time we'd gone through a kind of introduction to the estate, who had approval as to who would write it.
Yes.
Who wanted to know what direction to write. And Frank gave an absolutely brilliant, I mean, really a brilliant kind of insight of how he would structure the show. And had, unlike, clearly a British writing perspective, talked about it in a way that could see the potential to take the DNA of the story and weave it into a longer narrative that would be open-ended, that could really go on to a long-running series. Whereas we had been looking to utilise the book within a package of six parts. So that was
something. So it opened it up.
And Frank was, what was very exciting to me, you clearly, you're excited about this kind of writing, that what he was at, you know, Frank and Howard and he all identified the ideas that were core to this. You know,
yes.
you have a world that's turned upside down. It's a world of fascism. What are the choices you make? Who are the good people and what is good and bad? And what was interesting about them all is the way in which they reached, all three of them were planning, had all the kind of same fundamental interest in the idea, but different ways of achieving it.
Yes.
And what came over from, you know, what either the advantage of working with all three and seeing how, I suppose, over that period of clarifying what was difficult, what we should avoid and what we should open up in the story. So it was, for me, the most exciting working. It's been a privilege to work with Frank Slotnick. I really mean that. I mean, a very open, interesting, clever man. And I think probably, although there have been other examples of building a room with European writers, what Frank wanted to do, and was insistent on this, is that he would create this in the UK. So ironically, an Amazon show with an American writer, built with a European sensibility.
But actually was produced in the UK.
But one of the things that's come over this is that, and I really praise Amazon for this, is that, you know, the work began on the pilot episode.
Yes.
Bible. And their notes were not what I expected. Their notes were, slow it down. We don't want...
Did it want to be quite as fast-paced as that? Yeah. As it was originally?
They wanted a show which was much more of a character-led. They thought, and I thought, this is just exciting. I thought it will pull us into, you know, we want rockets flying. And what I think was, we thought, this is just the people that make it, so you all dream of what you think is
yes.
cool. But I think, and I know this is shared, and we now know that audiences share this, is that one of the most powerful scenes, one of them is the scene, but is when the son, Smith's son,
yes.
is at home.
Oh, that's fantastic. Because you feel a little bit of empathy for Rufus Sewell's character. Yes. You think this man is a monster who is happy to beat people up and execute them, and yet you feel empathy for this man.
So that, in the storytelling, I think, you know, partly from Amazon, partly them saying, we want to see an American in a world with a second and a third generation, and seeing that the danger isn't just these people are bad and they're evil and you've selected
them. They're far more complex than that.
They're complex, and you can identify with them.
Yes.
And the other was, and this is really beginning to develop, and I'm literally, I just read it, get short of it and showed you again. You know, first episode's coming
in.
It's an amazing beginning, just on this kind of idea that you are warning the world of something which is, you know, to many Americans and to many people in the world, it's just, well,
it's an abstract concept.
To place it in the family where you see, just as you've said, Smith doing one thing to achieve something, which you can think, oh, it's bonkers, or really evil, but, and then you see him in a family, and you see it as an American family.
So like a nuclear family, effectively.
Yeah, and to see America defeated and replaced by a set of ideas which are so close to, some arguments you hear both, you know, from around the world. So there's a resonance that says, take great care to the world, step over that line.
This is what could happen.
From a human point of view, not just from a violent horrific, or let's shock the audience more and more and more and more. And eventually you run out of shock. You can't be shocked anymore. A horrific, you know, opening bodies, blowing, destroying lives and so on. But here you have, you earn the right to see the reality for people who are evil, who have a morality. And this is the key point, and we want to do this, we try to do this throughout the season, it will grow in this next season, is to be able to justify the arguments for and against evil. You make them so close to these, so that you've really got to say, my God, we've got to raise our game here to argue. Ultimately, it's humanity and decency that you threaten, not the ideas or the, I've got this ideology that counters your ideology. It's basic human values that we have to look after.
Well, I was going
to
ask you about the location shooting, because a lot of it is shot in San Francisco and New York. Is that right?
No. What happened was the first episode was to be shot in Vancouver, and it was a tax credit.
Yes.
And there was a production problem. They couldn't find this. They just couldn't get ever the logistics of it together. So it was moved to Seattle, and it was all shot in
Seattle. So it's all
Seattle.
Studio?
It's studio. Wow. There's a lot in Seattle. And sorry, a lot in Vancouver, because after the first episode, the pilot, and it went, wow, everyone went fantastic. They immediately commissioned the series, so the next nine were shot in the original location, which is in Vancouver. And there, we built a lot, and there's all the kind of city stuff, and then there's an amazing, I mean, this is the power of America, and the sophistication of America, special effects.
So how much is this a physical set?
I don't know percentage-wise, but, you know, everything in the interior is a set. I mean, there's some models, but, you know, I don't know what to tell you. So in the pilot, you see a shot as Japan, get the bridge, the Golden Bridge. We all thought that was wow, but it was decided to do again.
Really?
And it was redone to make it more real, even more. And that was just, you know, it was like,
That was a fact.
Really? More creative. You know, when he comes out of the cinema and you all see, God, it's just a set, it's a lot.
And, wow.
Just crazy. New York, you know, you got the Iron Building in the middle of New York.
This is a decent sized budget for a show.
I don't know of, it's the most expensive thing I've ever heard of being made. We're in, you know it and I know it, but we're in a new world. This is not a studio, a conventional studio, this is a retailer. And a retailer is saying, you know, it's not how many people will watch this, it's we are building a brand and we can reach into trillions of people's homes, and the way to do it is produce drama that is at a higher level and aims to be better than the very best in the cinema. And to do that, we have the resources and you have to invest. But you're investing in not in a straight, do we get, you know,
X amount of viewing figures. It's more of a long-term thing to build quality in, basically. Yeah.
And I think it raises, you know, which your question leads to, for me, a really interesting question for Europe, is Amazon and Netflix are here in a big way, and growing and growing, and commissioning, whether it's a British producer, or a German producer, or an American producer.
Yes.
Like everything, like my mum before she died, my mum would sit and watch television. She'd have heard me go on and on and on about, you know, God, budgets are this, budgets are that.
Yes.
She would say to me, but sure, when you're watching someone, you never say, is this American or is it low budget?
No.
You just, is it good?
Does it engage you as a viewer?
So the world of, I think the challenge is Europe, is that you know, for absolutely understandable reasons, when television was invented, every government in the world created regulations. And created a business model, which was vertically integrated and really ground, it's the ground of which it stood on was the market in which it's produced on. So BBC world sales are a secondary. They're not designing to make a show. They're designing a show that will serve its domestic market. ITV the same, ZDF the same, TF1 the same, ProSieben. Every national broadcaster into the, you know, on a white charger comes, you know, it's not Amazon, it's Sky, it was cable and satellite. They began to challenge that. But I don't think that the shows that the Sky produced and the cable companies produced had the same ambition. It was more aping.
Well, it might have started with something like Battlestar Galactica, which I think was a co-production, which was an important show. Quality, it's not as fully realised as something like this or things like Daredevil, but it was the first step
on that ladder. It was a transition from domestic broadcasting. Now, what's interesting now is that you can tell from my I've got to be so careful. But you know, if I go to a domestic broadcaster, they not only, when I started with Channel 4 began, really produced a lot of Channel 4.
Okay.
Now Channel 4 would go, you'd go in the budget.
Yes.
It was a lady called Jeanette Ward. You would go to Jeanette, she would look at the budget, look at the script and say, actually you've under budgeted last year, you've over budgeted you've under budgeted that. Sometimes you've got but you went in with a financier who really understood the cost of making something. Now the European broadcaster says, here's a tariff, you know, £50, can you make it? No one checks the budget, no one looks at the budget. They trust, you know, they won't give it to anyone to make a show. They won't give you, they know your experience producing. producer. They know if you put your name to it, sign a contract, you will be delivering, you'll be default of £1 million. So let's say your tariff is, like this, because it is worth saying this, that I think it can be said. If you take a UK top tariff, it's let's say £800,000 to £900,000 an hour, stuck there for the last 10 years.
Yes.
That's top tariff. Mm. ITV, ZDF, TF1, wherever across Europe. Go to some of the HBO shows, Amazon shows now, then these are
even greater.
Five times. Yes. Six times, 10 times. You know, massively. Yes. So when you go, when I do put together a show, I'm going to do a show now. The next thing we're doing is...
Well, you can't tell me.
Yeah, well, I'm doing one thing with TF1 and one thing with Gomo, two Europeans, and two British writers, but working all that, spent most of their lives in Los Angeles, quite famous guy. They came to me with an idea. Now, we had a discussion before you came in. Do we go to Netflix or Amazon? Do we start with the UK broadcaster? Now, from my perspective, if I take it to, you won't be interested in the business side of it, but if I take this to Amazon,
yes,
they buy you out.
Yes. Outright, basically.
You get a good fee, and you're editorially involved in it.
Buzz.
And you're at the top of the pile of credits. I mean, my company is a big credit at the end of it. So from a point of view of moving into that market, wow, you know, we are the first independent to get a commission to make a major series like this. I mean, the BBC Worldwide things, they said theirs was better. You were the first. So it's silly that.
Yes.
But if I go then with shows now to a BBC, for the let's say $1 million an hour, I keep the rights.
Yes.
So if I can make a show for $1 million, I can own the rights to sell around the world. If I want to compete, however, with a show like an Amazon show, I would need at least five broadcasters who are putting up for the scale of the BBC to make, let's say, $5 million an hour, which is the kind of figures they're talking about, you know, average for these pictures. Now, you cannot do that. So what I do is I spend an inordinate amount of time putting together money from, let's say, two broadcasters and an investor, usually equity investor. This won't be of interest to you.
It's interesting.
We are at a point.
So it's co-production, but on a huge scale.
On a huge scale, basically. And I can do it, you know, like I did Invisible Woman, and you made that, or let's say, I'm going to give you figures, $10 million.
Okay.
$10 million.
Yes.
Now, who puts that together? I get $1 million from BBC. Bonus.
Yes.
I put them together, private equity, soft money,
pre-sales. It's like a mix. Yeah.
This
would have been impossible, say, 5 or 10 years ago.
And I wouldn't do it. It's for that.
No, fair enough.
It's a studio model, you know, people around the corner, it's long here. You talk to Sony. Mm. Sony will say, God, we don't understand the European model.
No.
We just pay for everything. Wow. But the difference is we pay for everything. By paying for everything, we own it.
Yes.
So I did a show with, and I'll give you this, it was a watershed for me. I did a show called a Stephen King novels, okay? And I think Stephen King, actually, again, is a very good writer. He's the best. I mean, really classic writer, but does, a particular kind of show. It's not my bag.
No.
Anyway, I got the rights.
Okay.
I was offered the rights by a friend in Los Angeles. He said, you can't set it up.
Can you do it? Yeah.
Can I do it? I signed the contract. Yes. A week later, I get a call from Sony to say, we want to do it.
Mm.
No, it's from A&E.
Yes.
So A&E want to do it. And I said, well, we've done a budget. We need about $11 million for the whole world. And they said, well, we'll put up $8 million, but we've got Sony will take the international rights. It's great. It's
okay.
A no-brainer. You know?
Yes.
And we've got, in the short period, I'd ask Pierce Brosnan, because in making films, you get access.
Well,
you open the door. So Pierce Brosnan, I thought, was perfect for this. He wanted to do it. He's a nice guy. Anyway, we did this. We put it. It was a three-way conversation. And Sony, of course, loved Pierce. A&E wanted a young American, but for good reason, because they're domestic market. But the characters they put on their list, all really talented actors, but none of them known in the international market. Pierce Brosnan, on the hand, known. So if even when the American studio work, they recognise if you wanted a sales company and a domestic broadcaster, the domestic broadcaster had to compromise to get the money to make the show. And Sony said, if you don't, then you won't. We won't invest the show. Now that was a microcosm of what European is now based. If I put together a show now, a big drama series, 10 parts, who in Europe is going to fund it? In this present time, there's like 3 or 4. And these 3 or 4 companies don't have the amount of money that the Americans have.
No.
And from a European point of view, tragedy, I think, the real excitement for me, on one hand, the plus side, the glass half full, is that there's some really talented storytellers in Europe. Really clever. It's just always been a storytelling culture. So we have real potential to make great drama. Is there a business model to meet the needs of a market that wants long-form, well-made drama with great art, great direction? There is an appetite for it, but the only people, or the very few people, are filling that are the Americans. And ironically, the people leading the charge are the Amazon and the Netflix. the studios behind that, you know, Sony are now doing it, you know, in the history of this, we're in geeks, and like, I know of another show, I mean, I was working on it with Microsoft, board commissioned us to do a series on cybercrime.
Oh, really?
And they're still working on it. But they, for 2 years, were going to get into a content maker. They've got
did a comic artist, a thing with Edgar Wright. It was a comic animated series. It was like halfway between like a series and a comic strip.
But that's because
that was funded by Microsoft. That was about two or three, as you remember it.
That, I do. And they wanted Xbox. Yes. They wanted the game site.
Yes.
They wanted
to be intricately part of the show.
For me to do a drama,
yes,
a straightforward conventional drama, and then on the Xbox to do these characters,
yes,
take these characters
and put them into a game environment. And
but there would be a relationship to the drama and the story. Now, they dropped out.
Yes.
I think that the other players got into this thinking along these lines. Actually, we could use conventional drama,
yes,
and we can do other things with it around it using this technology.
Yes.
But into the game now come Netflix and Amazon to say, guys, I think we make, there's an appetite for sophisticated. Mm. Really well-trained, hungry audience.
Yes.
Younger audience who want character-based, you know, The Wire, the, you know, the Breaking Bad.
Yes.
Which are dark, complicated, sophisticated.
Yes.
And really engage you. And people will watch 20 hours of this.
I know.
So that's where I think the challenge in Europe is to find an association, a partnership, a studio. And I know, you probably know more than I do, but there are a number of big groups.
Oh, yes.
Great studios in Europe.
Yes.
That can, like, be a one-stop shop. Mm. And come into the producer and say, you know, the French are trying to do this.
Yes.
Well, there's two examples of this. But they say, well, we've got 10 hours, you know, we'll do a crime show. Mm. We'll get the very best showrunner in. They brought an American showrunner crime to run this show. This was last year when I was these guys. And that's really interesting. But what I'm fearful of is that...
Oversaturation?
No, I think... Well, there's definitely...
Obviously, there's definitely...
Everyone's throwing money, I think, and there'll be big losses.
Mm.
But I think what's really exciting is the possibility of European storytelling, long form, that's not made like Hollywood movies.
No.
So you don't need... I don't think, if a good producer, which is what we're trying to do,
yes,
is trying to say, we'll make Man in High Castle, probably it's only the Amazon and the Netflix that could afford to do this and have the ambition to do it. But there's another form of drama, which is not cheapskate, low form, but because you and I know that in the cinema world, every year there'll be one or two films that are made for this amount that will make a massive
cost. It always happens every single year.
And there's always the tentpole movies.
Which are disastrous. Two or three of them are complete disasters.
I mean, I won't name them, but you and I know them. Now, inside the television model, then there's an opportunity for in that market. But at the core of it, what is exciting is, you know, this is very funny when we're making this Invisible Woman.
Yes.
I want to make this story, which is okay, but why I made want to make this story, they're very brilliant. Everyone has a good teacher at school, and I had this genius who was in Scotland in Edinburgh, and he said, I've got the worst class, you know, this is the second year, secondary school. I've got the dimwits in my class.
Mm.
He says, I've got to teach you about, I'm going to teach you Scottish literature, all the great scripts.
Yes.
I've got to teach you two English writers. One is Charles Dickens and one is Shakespeare. Shakespeare's over the top, you guys, you're all thinking you understand it. And the other is Dickens. And he took me on a journey with this man.
Mm.
And the thing that the first lesson he said, you know that all these great novels were written for a magazine.
Yes.
And
they were serialized.
He would write them on the train. Next day, he didn't know where he was.
No.
Of course, he knew where he was going. But he would write, and he went to Manchester, that would be written in the next episode. And I've always held this as a drama was a guy, what he did and what his teacher, she took me by the hand, like Philip, you know, he said, and Yetse said to me, McKinnon, you will always come against Gradgrind, and he went through the characters.
Yes.
And what he said, what he taught
is archetypes, basically.
He said, it didn't matter when they were written, whether they were top ass,
they
are around today. He said, I have to work with them. The school
is
run. And what is exciting, I think, is that here we are, long-form drama, with an industry with an appetite, not for, you could only make a two-hour film for the cinema. You can make 10, 20 hours of story we're telling, where a group of really talented people can sit around a room and, you know, you plot the story, and they can say, this character, Smith, he's done so many evil things. He comes home to his wife and his son is deeply ill, and he will throw everything away to look after his child.
Yes.
But will be morally conflicted. And I think, wow, couldn't you do this over 10 hours? You know, in The Wire. I mean, I thought The Wire was unbelievable. I mean,
I still haven't finished The Wire, actually. Yeah. I started it. I mean, I've seen all the Breaking Bad.
Yeah. These are dramas of another, they're another planet.
Mm.
I mean, they're not the only way of telling stories. You know,
I
watched this Reverence, what it was called, Reverence. It's a movie.
Oh, I saw The Revenant.
Yeah,
yes, Revenant. I did see that, yes.
Oh, I loved it. No, it's so terrible. God, how could it have what was the script? You must have been three words on the script.
Yes.
But what I'm saying is that, you know, the moment, all these problems that the producer yes. has, the challenge in Europe is that no one stops. There's no Amazon, there's no Netflix, there's no, no one you can knock on the door.
No.
So the producer has to be kind of backstreet, wheel and dealer.
He deals with as many people as he can.
And it's so efficient, so stupid. Mm. But nonetheless, there is no question that the market will eventually demand that
yes.
financial models are created, a mechanism is created, banking and investment, realizing if you can reach 50 million, 100 million people mm. with these shows, then you have something new and powerful.
Yes.
And the exciting thing is in Europe, I hope, and going back to this example of Man and High Hustle, my sadness was we couldn't make it with the BBC.
No.
But ironically, it maybe couldn't, maybe they were
it couldn't work. It couldn't work. Like
we would have maybe made 6 hours and it would have gone out and it wouldn't have had to have made it with Amazon, with people. And I'll tell you another thing which I thought was so exciting about Amazon. They said, we reach into, you know, all kind of types of people's lives. And this is just an anecdote, but I told you my daughter went you know, to Australia, had a baby. And when we were making this, Helen, my wife, never been to Australia. When the baby was born, she went out.
Yes.
And when she went out there, you know, she's just, she buys books like everyone. She got an email from Amazon saying, we think you'd be interested in Man and High Castle. Nothing to do with my baby.
No, no.
My wife. But just the fact that she has profiled as someone who might like Man and High Castle.
Yes.
Now, in the brief, Man and High Castle said, we want to appeal to this kind of audience.
Yes.
This kind of audience. Yes. This. Now, if I go to any of the British broadcasters and it's given a slot at 10 o'clock or 9 o'clock, they won't want it for this kind of level of kids, or they won't want
no,
it.
No, no.
And so it's exciting that editorially yes. they saw in this show a possibility of doing something rather serious,
yes.
rather dramatic, for lads with banging and bashing, geeks who were interested in sci-fi, you know, and my son-in-law, who's completely all his own, I was in driving with him on Sunday and we were going somewhere together and he goes, you've got to tell me, Stuart, what is the man, what happens next? I'm saying, I'm not
saying anything.
So that
yes.
for me is, from a perspective of, you know, British producer, going through this, we've come across, I think, we've straddled the changes that have gone in the industry. You know,
yes.
I've worked in the industry yes. as a domestic producer, in movies, in TV drama, in documentaries, and then came along this change. We were lucky enough to, we weren't visionaries or anything, but said, we're going to do this. Guy in Fremantle said, I'll be, it's a big money development, it's $500,000. So, you know, he said, no small company do that.
No.
So you develop that, went through all these ups and downs that could easily have fallen away. We could have gone into domestic broadcasting and just be one of a number of many programs, brilliant programs.
Yes.
Well made, I think. But the ambition and scale has allowed us to really realise this story, reach a global audience. And when you see the second season, it should not be what we're able to do. Mm. I tell you, this is going.
So when does it start shooting? Like October or something?
No, it's sooner than that.
Sooner.
Yeah, sooner. It's not very
soon. I mean, was it a 10-week shoot? Was it quite a long shoot, I presume?
It was a standard shoot. No, it was, you know, we were doing, because of the pilot, they're kind of awkward, because that was done in, you know, standard, you know, time, massive kind of fast thing. We had 3 months to get it up and running.
Oh, okay.
And get it done, from prep to shoot.
Wow.
But again, from the cycle of an American system, which is...
So it is structured like an American series, so there's a writer's room, and there's a showrunner, and there's a number of executive producers, and so each writer takes it in turn to get the credit for a particular episode, so they get to write either one or two episodes throughout the run. Frank is the showrunner, so he's an overall charge of the 13 episodes.
Yes. So what happens, Frank's appointed, he writes the Bible and the scenario.
Yes.
And then he assembles with execs.
Yes.
So there's me and a guy, David Zucker from Scott Free.
Yes.
And me and the family who stay.
Yes.
Giving executive credits. And they're really, you know.
So they've been very helpful,
they've been
presumably.
Actively involved in it and very.
Yes.
And got really excited and they're knowledgeable. You know, I don't
know. Well, of course, yes. I guess they know.
Anyway. But then, and then into that, a writer's room.
Mm.
And then what we as producers get is the writers then, with Frank, writing, they have different terms for it now.
So is it written over here then, basically, and then shot? So it's here, and then it's shot in Vancouver.
Right. And, you know, the writing process is, you know, one writer, they'll divide up, maybe five writers are writing the show. But Frank will do overwrites of these shows.
Of course,
I tell you, it's about too great.
Without going into any detail, you're into the second series of a show, so obviously you're going to have to go quite far beyond the 200-page novella.
All the elements in this new series are in the DNA of the story, and that's what I've been excited about, Frank's ability to... You mentioned, you said it, you recently read the book.
Yes,
then you thought, well, actually they've kept this...
But they've kept the flavour of the book, because it's, you know, it's an unusual approach on an alternate world story, basically, because it was very... The book is very stripped down and quite sparse, and I think that the TV series, or the first series at least, it did get that sense across on screen.
What we want to do now, in the second season, is to continue with our principal characters.
Yes.
So there are things that we just couldn't explore in the first season. You know, we wanted to set it up. We wanted to set up the resistance.
Oh, yes,
we
of course.
We wanted to establish the key characters, principal characters. And also, I think it's partly a learning curve, because you realise how, you know, the importance of, for example, the things you and I have been talking about, the American family and the consequences for a domestic life. I think at the beginning of the series, we didn't see that as something that would be as important as it became dramatically. So there's that. But now, I think, what we're able to do is, from this sort of basis, is to take the story to explore some of the things on a global scale.
Well, so, we see Japan and Germany again.
You will see, the novel has, obviously has what's happening in Europe.
Yes.
And it also what's happening in Africa and what's happening in Japan. So, you know, it follows what's there in the novel.
But it fleshes out.
And really kind of grabs that. And so our characters are into these worlds, and it infuses what's happening. I also think what has been, for me, I didn't realise, is that if you take a story which has something really profound and has a conceit, you can open this up in a way that your characters, as long as you keep to the kind of bedrock of what the thesis of the story, the conceit of the story, and the principles in which he's pursuing, you know, Dick is saying, what is real? What's real?
The last episode implies that we're possibly in another world, but we're not sure, you know, with the Japanese man who is, I guess he's probably one of the most sympathetic characters in the whole series.
There was something that it was Ridley said in a conversation, it was with Frank Deasy, and I thought it was quite funny. He said, Frank, I've got a suit that I've had for over 30 years. It's my favourite suit.
Yes.
In this world that we have, people don't throw away everything, particularly in a world which is not so consumer-led. So the idea is that we have to have something which is very familiar, is not wacky and weird, but at the same time, you must understand that certain things would have gone in different directions. Certain things wouldn't have been pushed as far. Some things would have been pushed further. You know, the rocket ship is the closest to Saturn. One of the things that I think we've really carefully interrogated is that the Japanese culture and Japanese fascism is rooted all the way down. It's unbroken. They didn't dress up in funny uniforms. They were dressed up in the clothes that they were dressed in 3,000 years ago. Hitler, on the other hand, had been dressed, you know, it was a kind of neoclassical look. There was a very interesting stage in the development of design when we got the original drawings, initial drawings from New York, and we said to designers, guys, this is all wrong.
Yes.
What Hitler was, you looked at, we told them, look at Leni Riefenstahl's films and other pieces.
So it's kind of like Bauhaus taken to its extreme world.
No, Bauhaus was, he was killing all the Jews of the Bauhaus.
I suppose.
But he was saying, it's, you know, when he comes in the Riefenstahl film and drives in like in a motorcade, the figures you see are Greek, neoclassical.
Yes, I suppose. Yes.
So we said what we want is not a glass box of New York.
No.
We want that old style, neoclassical.
With lots of grand figures. And
so
quite triumphalist, basically. Yes,
exactly. Triumph of the world. So in the Japanese style, you know, with the I Ching.
And it's more subtle.
It's a culture that's rooted, deeply rooted in the society.
Yes.
Now, these are things that have informed the drama, because the way in which, if you think the difference between the Germans, much more in many ways culturally akin to an American culture, but the Japanese, and they see our story, they see our Americans as different.
It's like when she goes to work for the Japanese man, and she can't, you know, look him directly in the eye. She has to bow and be very deferential.
Yeah. Now, these are things which I think in another kind of drama could have been, relevant.
Yes.
You know, it's just got two groups, allies, and this tension between the personality. And we've had, I think some of the things in the story have come from these academics. We've had various academics who come in to speak to the writers and give advice, and some beautiful things about traditions that have been brought into the story. Now, that's a texture which I think really good drama. I mean, I'm not making this a great art, but, you know, it does add
an extra level.
The care that's been taken, and then the way in which that's woven into the drama, gives it another dimension. And that's again, I think, it's America at its best, but it's Europe at its best. You know, great.
So it's like a fusion of the two. Got Free, so they're still a producing partner on the show.
Yeah,
but obviously, Ridley Scott is not involved day to day, because he's obviously far too busy with his film projects.
Yeah. He comes, you know, he comes in for bigger meetings, and there's a call now actually about cast for the next episode. He might be on that, I'm not sure he is, but sometimes he is. He's very good in cast and crew, production design.
Well, I mean, obviously he's a great artist.
And great people, you know, he'll say, look, I think you should look at this person or that person.
Yes.
You know, and he's had the experience of working with, I love him for that. You know, he can ever bring someone that's sort of not, you know, you've got television, you've got very talented people. He'll bring someone in who says, well, this is a film designer who I just think is a genius.
That'll be perfect for this,
And I think that kind of big, you know, it's like a good exec, you know, will come in, he leaves the, you know, the sort of you know, the nuts and bolts of it to the others. But he's an intuitive man. Mm. You know, that's what he's very interesting. You know, all these guys, they're always amazing guys. It's been a privilege to
work
with him. I mean, it really has. And I've learned so much. I just think this is, you know, and I think there's some of the writers that have worked in this room that have not had an opportunity to work in a, you know, in a room with, we had two showrunners working with our really prominent showrunners who were brought in to help in this first series. One was just for a week to advise and one stayed. And, you know, sitting in the room with these guys, you're
thinking, listening to them, it's amazing.
And highly, and this is not, they're not, the collaborators. Mm. That's what's been exciting. You know, yes. It's very much a culture of making something wherever there's no, the egos are all left at the door, put on the table. And I think there's something definitely to be found in that. You know, I was quite, I thought, well, this is more of a kind of machine-tooled industrial model. I've really changed my view of that. I think this, if this is typical about the way in which a room has created stories, this is a very kind of exciting. You have to have someone who can steer it, you've got to have someone who can manage that, you've got someone who can just, at the end of the day, sit down and say, look, I will rewrite this dialogue, sort out problems.
Mm.
But to have this kind of pyramid of talent in a room, sorting stories and coming up with ideas, is, I mean, it shows.
Yes.
And it doesn't feel formulaic to me.
No.